The Claremont Army Cab was one of the best in Australia, and at its peak, around 2,000 recruits were training here for service in the Great War. With the exception of the 12th Battalion, which had trained at Pontville, all Tasmanians who enlisted in the state for World War I trained at Claremont. For many, it was their last taste of home.
The Claremont camp was actually on a property known as Ashburton Farm. The Army acquired the lease of that property in 1911 for use by the remount unit. Now, the remount unit was a militia unit looking after all the horses that were used by the military in Tasmania. Once the first contingent left Pontville on the Katoona and the Geelong on the 20th of October 14, they had realised by that point in time that one of the problems they had out there was primarily a lack of good water supplies.
Obviously, the fact that it had been a remount depot made it very easy for the Army to move into the site. So developing that as an Army camp was really a no-brainer. And having access to the mainline railway meant that troops could come from both north and south directly to the camp. It was on an urban water supply. It had everything.
And facilities were fairly rough, but as it developed, more things were built. We have a diary written by Private Clifford Charman. His entry for the 11th of March 1915, he says, the only facilities for a bath were
cold showers, practically in the open, as these were protected only by a very dilapidated Hessian screen. Swimming in the Derwent was encouraged and was a welcome change from the monotonous squad drill. Discipline was strict, and the only leave allowed was a few hours on a Friday night.
When most of us went to Hobart by special train.
They were given leave. I mean, Claremont was a dry camp. So there was no alcohol on the camp as far as I'm aware. One of the problems when you have a large body of men and soldiers is they like to get out in the town. And so having them at Claremont meant they were far enough away that they couldn't cause too much trouble.
Ray Salter says his father, Private Eric Salter, spoke about walking miles to enjoy leave with his cobbers.
They got their leave pass and go into town and that once a week, and mainly on foot. Because there wasn't much transport about in them days. It happened so quick because they wasn't there that long. They were sent on their way to the front line.
Some of the facilities that they had were laundry, a dental surgery, a hairdressing saloon, fruit shop, shower bath, a ladies' retiring tent for visitors, a post office. The YMCA built a hall which housed a piano and a free library and free writing material so that the men could write to their loved ones.
A larger part of Triffitt's Point was used a lot for the training of soldiers. They had some fairly substantial trench systems for fellas to practice their military movements in and around and from.
Yeah, I play golf out there today.
Darryl Vincent can still see where his father Les trained with grenades and around the trenches.
There's a place where you can see where the trench has gone through. They actually practiced with clay. They got clay and made it up to about the same size and weight and everything as a grenade, and they'd throw those. One of his mates got hit fair between the eyes with this clay.
They would be practicing digging trenches, they'd be practicing digging in gun emplacements, as they would be required to do if they were artillerymen. Practicing getting in and out of trenches as the war progressed to a stalemate on the Western Front. Information would have been fed back to Australia through the military authorities in what trenches looked like, designs of trenches. The fellows, once they'd be got out of bed early in the morning at Reveille at 6 a.m, they'd have a first parade or within an hour. Then later on they'd enter into their chaining. There'd be some steeplechasing, round over the sticks, Swedish drill. 3 hours in the morning and two in the afternoon were devoted to solid physical training. Some were put in squad and company drills, musketry instruction, bayonet practice fighting, and others armed with picks and shovel work to go out practicing digging their trenches. Bayonet training, that would be done with an instructor. They would be gathered in lines and given their drilling, present, thrust, parry, that type of thing. They'd be lined up two lines facing each other with their bayonets fixed, and the instructor would give them their words of command, point, thrust, parry, and they'd practice these so that they became rote. A lot of the training when they did it was against one another, but of course they'd have their scabbards on their bayonet so they couldn't hurt each other. But they'd go through the motions of thrusting at a person, and if they missed the thrust or it was parried by the other, then they'd come up for a butt stroke to the jaw of the other person.
Keith Salter reckons his father, Private Eric Salter, trained with some very basic firearms.
Munition and guns were very, very scarce there. They had very little to train with before they went away.
Later on, as machine guns became more readily available, they were introduced to the Vickers machine gun and the Lewis machine gun in Tasmania, but in the early stages of the war, they wouldn't have got experience in using those guns until they got to Europe. There were some Lewis guns floating around, but there weren't too many of them either. And any guns that were being produced were quickly put into the front as the machine gun became the queen of the battlefield, as they say.
Whenever he went past then, he'd say, well, we should salute the camp every time we go past it because of the fallen of his friends who lost during the war, I guess.
Our speakers included John Lennox of the Military Heritage Foundation, heritage consultant John Wadsley, and historian Dr. Catherine Evans.